Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. And my guest today is Ellen Brown. I think most listeners know Ellen. I'll give Ellen a very brief introduction because I want to read something before we get into trying to get in as many topics as we can. We decided we probably need the whole day to cover them all, but we'll do the best we can. The thing I want to stress about Ellen is her absolutely fabulous book, Web of Debt. Absolutely must reading. Absolutely must. Anybody who doesn't know about it, go to Ellen's website, Web of Debt, or Google Ellen's name. It explains what the Federal Reserve is all about. And it's got so much more in it than that, how it usurped the money creation power, how we can get it back. And the book is just loaded with vital information. Let me mention something. I get a daily update from an economist who tells things straight, David Rosenberg. He used to be with Merrill Lynch. I don't know how they put up with him because he was an honest guy, but he's with a small Canadian firm now. And he put out a daily commentary. He's talking about soaring stock prices today, and he's trying to explain it because it really is kind of insane that given the things that he points out and others, how on earth can stock prices be going up so high? And he asks, who's doing the buying? Corporate insiders are selling. The public is out of the market. Companies that usually do buybacks are doing 72% less than last year, a year ago. So what's going on? He attributes a lot of it to program trading, short covering. My attribution is more to market manipulation. But he says this, never before has the S&P rallied 60% from a low in such a short time frame as 6 months. And never before have we seen the S&P rally 60% over an interval in which there were 2.5 million job losses. What's normal is to see 2 million jobs being created to justify a rally like this. And what's normal is for the market to rally 20% from the trough to the time the recession ends. By the time we're up 60%, we're well into the third year of recovery. So he's scratching his head. He says, in other words, we're witnessing a market event that's way outside the distribution curve. And he says, while some pundits explain it by abundant liquidity, he's very dubious. He says, if it's a case of endless stream of cheap money, we're reminded of Japan, where they kept interest rates at rock-bottom lows for years. But the S&P, the Nikkei in Japan is still 70% below its all-time high 2 decades ago, 70% below. So he dismisses liquidity as the way to get a rally like this in a sustainable market. Oh, I'm trying to scan through this quickly and just cover it real fast. He really ends up saying that liquidity aside, it's really not a good explanation. So he says it sounds good. But we really don't have a clue what's really going on. Any other salient points in this? No, that's about it. He's really saying that there has never been a rally event like this in market history. Helen, I haven't even welcomed you to the program. What do you make of this?
Oh, thanks, Stephen. Hi. Always great to talk to you. I think liquidity does have a lot to do with it. The thing is, it's not just the fact that interest rates are very low. I mean, that is what created liquidity in Japan. But it's the fact that the Federal Reserve, on the sly, has been putting huge amounts of money into the system. I mean, they said recently, Ben Bernanke said recently, that the crisis is over. And so he's
sure. He had that in there. Let's take a break.
Okay.
Okay, like that.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Ellen, let me just add a couple more comments, then you jump in and try to make some sense out of this. You can do it better than I can. Rosenberg says that liquidity and technicals can certainly touch off whippy tradable rallies, but they don't take you all the way to a sustainable bull market. Only positive economic and balance sheet fundamentals can do that. And he said in other commentaries, we really don't have that now. There may be a little clue here, a little clue there, but we really don't have it. And the consumer is out of the market. One more point. This is on another article that I spotted, and I've seen a couple on this. Money and credit today are contracting at Great Depression levels. So how do you square that with soaring stock prices? And this a Bank of International Settlements economist, a guy named William White, from 1995 to 2008, trying to see if this is a quote by him. It's either a quote by him or I think it's related to the BIS. And the quote says, both bank credit and M3 money supply in the U.S. have been contracting at rates comparable to the onset of the Great Depression since early summer, raising fears of a double dip recession in 2010 and sliding into debt deflation. And it goes on like this. Oh, here's another comment. There has been nothing like this in the U.S. since the 1930s. The rapid deterioration of money balances is madness. This is another economist. So what do you make of all this, Ellen? It certainly doesn't seem to be a time when the coast is clear and it looks like it's clear sailing ahead. Or do you disagree?
No, I agree. But I think what's going on, Ben Bernanke, you know, the Chinese were getting very nervous about us monetizing our debt. Every time they kept bringing this up, but we hope you're not monetizing your debt. In other words, printing money to buy your bonds, because that would supposedly dilute the value of the Chinese bonds, which are ample, you know, $2 trillion worth or so. And so Ben Bernanke then in August said, don't worry that we've turned a corner, or actually I guess he said it a few days ago, we've turned the corner, and so we no longer need to monetize. He said in the spring that they were buying $300 billion of U.S. long-term bonds. But so he says we're terminating that program. We don't need to do that anymore because we're technically out of the woods, meaning he says it might not feel like it, like you might not have a job, you might be in foreclosure, you might be out on the street, but technically we've turned the corner. But in fact, what they're doing, so they've quit directly monetizing the debt, but what they're doing massively is this sort of swap with other central banks, where they haven't quit buying the agency debt, which is Fannie and Freddie bonds, which they're basically government debt because we've basically nationalized them. So what they're doing is they're putting all this money out there to buy the agency debt from the other central banks, and then the other central banks buy the U.S. government debt. So
which ones? China?
Well, largely China, yeah.
Largely China. Well, another guest in this program, Bob Chapman, he's put out information that China in recent months have been net sellers of U.S. treasuries. If he's
yeah,
right.
Well, that's true. I read that in, let's see, if I can find the article. Anyway, there's hugely purchasing agency debt, and our debt is still getting funded. So that's what I think is happening there. And then they have to make him look honest when he says that we've turned the corner. They, of course, have to make the stock market look good. And we know they can manipulate any market any way that they want to. So I would suspect there is manipulation to make it go up. Unfortunately, when money goes into the stock market, that has nothing to do with jobs. In fact, that's a bad place to put your money. Let's assume that even if the government was just printing massive amounts of money and putting it out there into the economy, if it goes into the stock market, it is not going to stimulate the economy because that is gambling. I mean, that's just when you buy stock, you are not putting your money into a company. You are buying the stock from the last person that owned it. The only people that put money into the company is the first issue, the initial public offering, and that's not on the stock market. So the stock market are all secondary trades. So you're just buying from the last person in the hopes that the stock will go up and in the hopes that you can sell it to some other sucker when it starts to go down who will then bear the losses of the thing. So it's all gambling. So that's not where you want your money to go. But it does look good. People look at the stock market and they say, oh, good, everything's fine because the stock market's going up. It's considered an indicator, although it's not really. Plus, you know, the Dow is just 30 stocks. It's not that many stocks.
Oh, indeed. So, of course, the S&P is going up. The NASDAQ is going up. At the same time, Ellen, I'm sure you'd agree, in normal times, in a healthy economy, the economy and the stock market will go up together. And it'll be at a time when jobs are being created, wages are rising, prosperity is increasing for everyone, the way it happened post-World War II. I think there were some bumps in the late 40s, but the 1950s until it got later in the decade, and then the 1980s and the 1990s, incomes began declining in the 1970s. So they really haven't kept up, declining, adjusted for inflation. And I think there was a brief period in the 1990s when the economy was rolling along, and for a few years incomes did rise, but it didn't break the three-decade trend of incomes declining. And they certainly have not kept up since 2000. So it's a very dire time. The person in the street, I think somebody, I forget who, talks about the Doug Jones average, referring to the average Joe on the street compared to the Dow Jones average, and there's a big disconnect between the two.
Yeah. Well, and the stock market includes many stocks that, for instance, it includes foreign stocks, and they're going up because the Chinese really are putting money into development, and they really do have jobs. Their employment's going up, and India does too. India's doing very well because everything's focused on internal development and always has been. They didn't get into all this derivatives and foreign trade and stuff. Plus, gold and silver stocks are included in the stock market, and they're going up because the dollar's going down and because the Chinese, instead of buying dollars, are now buying gold. So they just can't keep a lid on. They manipulated the gold market, you know, for years. But they can't really keep a lid on it anymore because every time the manipulators push the stock down or the gold down, then the Chinese jump in and buy it because they want it at those cheap prices. So it's going to just keep going up. So it's definitely a good investment. So all those things are mixed into the stock market, which therefore winds up going up. But I agree that whoever manipulates all this, they just like to see it go up and down. You know, they'll push it up. It's the old pump and dump thing. So they'll push it up and they'll ride it up, and then because they know when it's going to collapse, then they sell at the top and let somebody else, or they actively short sell it on the way down. So they make money both ways. That's what a hedge fund is. It hedges their bets by making money both ways. So all they want is volatility. They want it to go up and they want it to go down and up and down.
Well, I once had a currency trader, not a big time guy, but a currency trader on the Chicago Exchange, wherever they trade the currencies. And in a conversation with him once, this was some years ago, he doesn't live here anymore, he said, exactly what you just said, Ellen. The thing that we hate the most is to have a calm, stable market. We want volatility, up, down. As long as it's volatile, that's the way we make money. And I don't think he was an insider, but I guess if you're smart enough and swift enough and you know what you're doing, you can, and you're lucky enough, you can come out ahead more times than when you're wrong. But I've got a question for you. With the dollar falling so heavily right now, it really has sunk a great deal over the past few months or whatever. How much lower it will go, I don't know. I guess it's a sign that there's great nervousness With so much money being created, it really becomes no more than confetti. So why the devil do the smart players want to hold dollars under this condition? Why would foreign central banks keep going along with the Fed to buy our treasuries or buy our agency securities? Why would they do that? I guess buy our treasury or buy both. Why would they do that? They're getting depreciating dollars, so their investments are going down.
Well, as you pointed out, there has been a huge contraction in the money supply. There's like $10 trillion disappeared when the shadow lenders went away, when they quit buying mortgages, securitized mortgages from the banks. So that what the Federal Reserve, in pumping all this money out there, what they're doing is replacing that money that's been lost, and they still can't keep up. So we're actually still in a deflationary scenario. The reason gold's going up is not really because, I mean, the dollar is going down and gold always goes up when the dollar goes down, but it's really because the Chinese are madly buying and other central banks are buying gold because they don't want to buy dollars anymore. They're nervous about buying dollars. But here's what I think. What Bernanke should do is just say, yes, we're monetizing the debt, and now let's talk about honesty in government. And then he should say why he's doing it and why it's a good thing. I read another economist who thought he was the best Federal Reserve chairman we'd ever had because he was very...
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Bernanke, the best Fed chairman we've ever had. I guess this guy had a great short position on the way down, and very smart enough to get back in at the March lows. Ellen, I guess on that scenario, I probably would call Bernanke the greatest of all Fed chairmen.
Yeah, well, and look at who do you have to choose from? Look at all the Fed chairmen. Is there anybody back there that stands out in your mind as a brilliant economist?
Well, the only one that stands out in my mind is the guy who said he would take the job of the Fed chairman was to take the punch bowl away when the party got going, William McChesney Martin. I mean, he was
right.
Enough
there
to get
there was some old ones, right? Yeah, the Fed actually wasn't too bad after World War II, I guess.
Was that Martin or Eccles?
Yeah,
said that?
Yeah, it was McChesney Martin. Yeah.
McChesney Martin, okay. Well, I mean, all Alan Greenspan and Bernanke have done, and Bernanke before the crisis broke, they just kept filling the punch bowl as people drank from it. They just kept filling it up with more.
Right. So Greenspan created this disaster, and poor Bernanke, the left, was the thing. And the thing is, he can't come out and say what he's doing. So he has to. He's doing all this shell game. I found the article that I was. It was Chris Martinson, How the Federal Reserve is Monetizing Debt, and he didn't actually say who it is they're doing these swaps with. But basically, if you look at these charts, there's a huge amount of agency debt being bought, Fannie and Freddie bonds. And so that money is good. That's how we're monetizing debt, only we're doing it through the agency debt instead of through the government debt. But the whole idea is to fill that, because the private debt has collapsed. The idea is to fill that gap with public debt. And in that sense, Bernanke's doing the right thing. But what I think he should do is come clean. You know, there's all this worry about an audit because if the Fed were audited, it's like making sausage. You know, if you saw how money was made, everybody would freak and there'd be a run on the dollar, which there probably would be. You know, he's probably right, unless you can get public opinion behind you. So what he should do is come out, come clean and say, yes, we're monetizing public debt. And here's the reason. All of our money comes from debt. There's no money in our system except loans. And all the private loans have shrunk. There's people, you know, they're not, banks say they're fully loaned up, but the reason they can't lend any like they used to is that the shadow lenders that used to take the loans off their books, making room for more, have gone away. So even though the banks are trying, they can't make the loans they used to make a few years ago. Plus, the borrowers just aren't there to borrow. They're getting all nervous and they don't you know, most people are trying to pay off their debts and not incur new debts. So to replace that, the government has to create money. But it's a good thing for the government to create money. The very best way we can monetize our debt is through the Federal Reserve, because we get it interest-free or almost interest-free. They rebate the interest after deducting our costs. Whereas if we do it through all these private entities, we have to pay a big chunk of interest. And it's still money that's created out of thin air, because ultimately that money comes from some bank that creates it on its books and charges interest for it.
But the problem is that the money is going to the bankers and not into the economy. So how on earth do you square that? I mean, unlike China, you wrote a great article on China. China does not give the bank. China's system is quasi-private or quasi-public. China has a lot of control over its banks, so you don't have banks running the government. China runs the government, and everything is kept in balance, or a lot more so than in this country. So China has stimulated its economy. The economy is growing. We're stagnating. I guess we can look at the official numbers, Alan, and you never know what's accurate, what's being manipulated. But even if China is hyping the numbers to make them look better than they really are, they seem to be moving in the right direction. We're not. So if we were doing, if I remember what you wrote in your China article, if we were following the same prescription as they are, we'd be in much better shape than we are now.
Right. Well, the difference is China owns those big development banks. You know, there are four big development banks that used to be the People's Bank of China. And the government owns those banks. And so those banks create credit on their books like any bank does. And then they give it directly to the state-owned enterprises, which are making stuff. You know, they give it to businesses, which are making stuff, and they give it to the large corporations. Supposedly, they're giving some to the small businesses, but it's not trickling down like it should. But anyway, they're putting the money out there in the economy for productive purposes, and they're giving it directly to these businesses, which make things. So the government knows where this money's going. They're not giving it to banks that then decide who to lend it to, and instead of lending it to businesses like they're supposed to, they wind up speculating with it or lending it, you know, buying up other banks, et cetera, paying them big bonuses. So they own their banks. They create their own money just like we. So that's what I'm saying. If our government funded its federal debt through the Federal Reserve, which is like owning its own bank, I mean, it is, it's captive central bank, even if it's privately owned, because it has to rebate the interest. So the government should just walk over to the Fed and say, here, we've got all this in lock, we've got this much money that we need. You know, this is, we're going to have to monetize this debt. We don't have enough taxes to cover it. So turn this into dollars, and we're going to spend it on businesses. And then if they took that money and actually put it into development, it would not be inflationary, because you would create things, so you would increase supply along with demand, and prices would remain stable, and you would create jobs, and everything would get rolling again.
Well, piggying into that, and you covered that so well in Web of Debt. Let's take another break.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Ellen, you explained so well in Web of Debt that creating money does not create inflation. Creating any amount of money does not create inflation, so long as the money is put to productive use. If it goes to speculation, that's another issue altogether.
Right, or if it goes to pay off foreign debt, that'll create inflation for sure. Like in Zimbabwe, they were madly printing Zimbabwe dollars because they owed debts in U.S. dollars. Then they didn't have the power to print U.S. dollars. So, and the speculators knew that that's what they were up to. So when they go to buy dollars, U.S. dollars, the price of the dollar would go up and up, which meant the price of the Zimbabwe dollar would go down and down, or the value of it. And that's what collapsed the currency. The same thing happened in Germany. Michael Hudson says that all those huge hyperinflations have always resulted because of an effort to pay off foreign debt in a currency that you don't have the power to print. Now, fortunately, we do have the power to print dollars, and all our debts are owed in dollars, so we don't have that problem. I mean, things might change. It might be that the Chinese start demanding payment in yuan or something, and then we could have a problem. But I think the Chinese were totally boycotted, you know, during the 50s, 60s, 70s when they went communist, and they turned all the resources inward and developed, and they came out stronger for it. We were totally cut off when we were colonies, and that's when we became strong. I think everybody's worried about the collapse of the dollar vis-a-vis the rest of the world, but I think we've got everything we need in our own country. We've got energy resources that we haven't developed. They're there, and we just don't have the money to develop them. So if we actually printed our own money, monetized our own debt, I mean, Ben Bernanke should just say, yes, we're monetizing our own debt, and you should monetize your debt, too. This is what every country should do, and this is what the international banking cartel doesn't want you to do and doesn't even want you to know that you have the power to do it. But you should do that. Create all the money you need for development. Put that money into development, and you will have a booming economy, and you can have everything you need right in your own country. You don't need to be dependent on all this foreign trade that has to increasingly make more and more profits just to keep the bubble going.
Well, you know, I think that makes so much sense, Helen. And on the one hand, I can counter your argument and then refute my own counter by saying that the corporations that control this country, mainly the Wall Street ones, but so many other big industries, agribusiness, way back at one time, the auto giants that are now auto pygmies, or whatever, a lot less giant than they were years ago. But these are global corporations, so their market is the world, not the U.S. So they want to be able to do business all over the world, and if they do a little more in one place and a little less in another, all that matters is they meet their business plan goals. The counter to this argument is that the U.S. is such a big piece of the global pie, about a quarter of the world's economy, until recently, but let's just call it a quarter of the world's economy, that if the U.S. falters, the rest of the world is impacted. So it makes eminent sense to make the U.S. strong and prosperous, because with a strong and prosperous U.S., other countries will benefit as well, so the global economy will benefit, so these global corporations will do well. So your argument makes a lot of sense.
And that's just what the Chinese are doing. They're putting their resources inward. And I just heard on CNBC this morning, it was an Indian investor, I guess he's a banker, but anyway, he was talking about how well India's doing. Even in the downturn, they were at 5% growth. And the reason is they never got into all this foreign trade thing. It's all about internal development. And so they're focusing inward on their own productivity. That's what we should do, too. We're a world leader. At the very least, we should be keeping up with China by also developing our internal resources. But the reason we're not is we think we don't have the money. But of course we have the money. If we have the money to put up $24 trillion to backstop the banks, which is apparently what the bailout has now come to. I mean, that's our total commitment. We've got a few trillion to put into internal development of our own resources and, you know, housing, all those things that we really, roads, all those things we desperately need to build and make.
Oh, there's so much to do. There really is so much to do. Neglected stuff that we haven't done for years. And all of that money created, Ellen, could be put to productive use for years to come. And this economy could boom if we did something like that. I didn't mention this in an email before we went on air, but I guess you just came back from a monetary conference in New York. Is that right?
Yeah, it was actually a conference on We Demand Transparency.
Oh, well, monetary conference is coming up in Chicago.
Yeah, that's next week. Yeah.
Oh, well, the only thing I wanted to ask, was there anything dramatic that came out of the conference that would be of interest to listeners?
I think my own lecture was, I got a standing ovation, so I'll tell you what I spoke.
And your lecture was about what?
And actually, they featured me as a speaker, which is it was sort of a 9/11 conference, but it was they've moved on. You know, 9/11 is still last year, as they say. So now it's so I spoke on the economic 9/11, which was Lehman Brothers, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and how it was actually orchestrated. It was the one and only time that they really let the free market work, and they just let that go totally because they needed one big collapse to extort this huge bailout from Congress. And in fact, it was on 9/11 specifically that the stock market, or that the stock of Lehman was bombed, that it had its biggest drop and its biggest turnover ever. And it was on 9/11 of the previous year, oddly, that Northern Rock it dropped by 30%. The stock dropped that day by 30%. And that's when lines started forming outside Northern Rock. And we first ever even heard of bank runs. You know, that was the first bank run that England had had for 141 years. So that was what triggered the whole bailout thing in England. And then Lehman Brothers triggered it in the U.S. And, of course, it was Henry Paulson that extorted all this stuff. Well, Henry Paulson was head of Goldman Sachs when, in its heyday, when it was madly creating all these collateralized debt obligations, which were the thing that basically caused the whole, you know, caused the housing market run-up and caused the collapse. So Paulson was scrambling around saving his own firm, really, by collapsing Lehman Brothers. I mean, I showed how this was all orchestrated. And and that precipitated $700 billion bailout of the banks. But also there was the $85 billion bailout of AIG, which is the insurer, the counterparty to the collateralized debt obligations of Goldman Sachs, which was the biggest beneficiary out of that bailout. So Paulson did all that, I would say, to save the skin of his own company and maybe his own skin. I mean, he was heavily implicated, and there's a lot of conflict of interest questions there, you know.
Oh, boy, was there ever. Your article on Lehman was really terrific, and you mentioned that Lehman was in no worse shape than the other big banks. So why did Lehman go and the others survive? Even Bear Stearns was going under, and J.P. Morgan Chase bought it up at a small price. The initial price they were going to pay was too embarrassing, so they raised it up a little bit. It was still peanuts.
$10 a share.
But they say Bear Stearns, they let Lehman go. Oh, I think there's no question that this was all planned, all orchestrated. Scare the pants off Congress to get that $700 billion. Save Goldman, I guess save Citigroup, save Bank of America.
But there's another wrinkle, and this is what I talked about, that arguably they did intend to save Lehman, and arguably it was the Brits that collapsed the whole thing. Because with Bear Stearns, you know, they were negotiating, frantically negotiating over the weekend, and they came up with a buyer, which was J.P. Morgan, and then the Fed provided the funds for this bailout. And so you didn't, even though it didn't help the shareholders of Bear Stearns any, of course, they got wiped out, but Bear Stearns didn't go through bankruptcy. And Lehman Brothers also, they were frantically negotiating over the weekend for a buyout, but the buyer was Barclays Bank, and Barclays needed a waiver of a rule, a British rule that said that they had to have shareholder approval to underwrite the debts of Lehman Brothers. And it was Alistair Darling, the equivalent of their Treasury Secretary, you know, their Chancellor of the Exchequer, who wouldn't give the waiver, but he didn't give it till the very last minute. I mean, you know, that wasn't clear until Sunday when it was too late to do anything about it, because that's when the Japanese stock market opened, and then it was all over at that point. So, I mean, the reason that it looked suspicious was that Alistair Darling also could have saved Northern Rock, but he wouldn't do it. In that case, it was Lloyd's of London that was the buyer, but Lloyd's needed a loan from the Bank of England, and the Bank of England wouldn't give it, and Alistair Darling could have overridden the Bank of England, and his staff said that that's what he should do and not let this bank go down. But he wouldn't do it. And the reason was it would make Gordon Brown look bad, who was the prime minister, because when Gordon Brown was Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had given the Bank of England its independence, and everybody lauded him for this move. And so if they countered the Bank of England, this would go against all that. Well, Gordon Brown is the big New World Order guy. You know, he has several times used language very like what David Rockefeller used, where they said, all we need is a major crisis and we'll have our new world order. Gordon Brown has said the very same thing. You know, it just takes a crisis, and that will to precipitate this new global financial order. So in January of this year, he said something like, basically said to his, you know, people in England, don't worry, it's just the birth pangs of a new global financial order. Well, why would you use that language unless you were part of unless you'd heard that in a group setting? I mean, it's just not the type of language you would normally use if you were a leader of a country that was going through a big depression, unless you'd been off to Bilderberger meetings or somewhere where they talk like that. I mean, they actually believe in this stuff, that it would be better for the globe to have a global regulator, a global bank, a global currency. But the problem is it's all going to be issued privately, and it's coming out of the Bank for International Settlements as the global banker. And that's where the Financial Stability Board is, that was approved by the G20 in England, you know, at the London G20 summit in April.
And the only way you can do something this radical is under an unusual situation, Ellen, as you know, like a global economic crisis, like a major global economic crisis. And then they come up with these schemes that they had planned months or years in advance, and they hatch them. And this is a new way to fix the world. Well, their idea of fixing the world is to give the powerful more power than ever. I think part of the Lehman collapse and Northern Rock collapse was with the G20 meeting in April this year, the idea of a financial stability board, a global regulator, and you've got the BIS, the global central bank of central bankers. But let the big boys get more powerful, crush the little guys, forget about the ordinary people like you and me. I mean, we can just be cast by the wayside. But this is their big chance to get the kind of power that would be impossible to get under a normal situation, and it was the same thing as the 9/11 event that let the Bush administration wage two imperial wars, enact all kinds of police state laws in the U.S. Fast. I mean, without even any debate in Congress.
The
Patriot Act was passed in 99-1.
Yeah, that's the shock doctrine. You need the shock. My concern is that the Financial Stability Board is given unlimited power. There's no, it's not a democratically set up board, and they're going to have the power to regulate anything financial. So my concern is that they're going to come out with this order that says it's not sound financial practice for any country to issue their own money or to borrow from their own central bank. You have to borrow from the international bankers, which means they will have the power to create money around the world, so they'll have control of the money power, which is what they've obviously been aiming to do for 200 years, ever since, we know that from what Mayor Amschel Rothschild said, allow me to issue and control a nation's currency, and I care not who makes its laws. That's what they're up to. They want to issue the currency of the world privately and lend it to us.
In
and the reason
global,
I think that's what they're... Go ahead.
In a global currency.
Sorry?
Issue have a global currency being the dominant currency.
Yeah. I mean, you can make case arguments for a global currency, but what we don't want is a global currency issued privately by a global central bank that we have to borrow from. We have no control over our own monies. The reason I think that's what they're doing is that somebody from Sweden wrote to it's one of those Google groups, the social credit Google group. He said that Sweden owned its own central bank. They were the first central bank in 1660-something, but it was publicly owned. And they did very well borrowing from their own central bank, which basically created the money and lent it to the government, which then spent it, which in effect the government created its own money, until they joined the EU. And then the EU told them they could no longer borrow from their own central bank. They had to borrow from they had to use the EU currency. And so from then on, their economy's been going down, down, down. And the same thing happened in Canada when they first had their central bank. Their central bank is publicly owned, and after World War II, the economy was booming. But at that point, they were actually borrowing money from their own central bank, and 50% of the money supply, 25 to 50%, was created by the government, and the rest was created by the banks. But then when we went through this whole monetarist thing with Milton Friedman, you know, the whole fear of inflation, the sentiment was that you couldn't borrow from your own central bank. So even though they own their own central bank, they don't borrow from it. They borrow from the international bankers now. And so now they have a huge debt, which is growing exponentially because of the compound interest problem, when they could have been issuing their own money. So now their economy is going downhill, just like everybody else's. They're in the debt trap. But in those years from World War II to the late 70s, when they actually borrowed from their own central bank, their economy did really well. And so they're a case in point. I'm going to write about that as an example.
Oh,
so that's what we should do.
Oh, I think that's a great topic. But the general topic overall, Ellen, that, again, you cover so well in Web of Debt and so many of your articles, they're really running an economy right, if you get down to the basics of it, it's really not all that complicated. There are things that we know work. There are things we know do not work. So why do the ones that don't? Why not concentrate on the ones that do? But it may not be good for the big banks that just don't want to do it that way. Oh, we got to take another break and then wrap it up.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Ellen Brown. Ellen, I can't resist asking you to make a couple of brief comments about your brand new article. It's still a work in progress, a landmark decision by the Kansas Supreme Court that gives some hope to distressed homeowners. Want to mention what that's all about?
Well, the court held that MERS, which is the electronic, it's a company that records mortgages electronically and then goes into court and brings foreclosure actions, that MERS does not have standing to bring a foreclosure action. Well, MERS holds 60 million mortgages in the country. It's like half the new mortgages in the country are assigned over to MERS. So if they can't bring a foreclosure, nobody can bring a foreclosure. The reason they did it, the reason MERS was set up, was for the it stands for, I don't know, mortgage electronic something, something. Anyway.
Looking for mortgage electronic registration systems. I'm looking at your article.
Okay. The reason, it's a work in progress. The reason they did it was that the reason they set up MERS, it goes along with this whole securitization of mortgages thing. So it was that whole scam that was set up by Goldman Sachs and, you know, Henry Paulson and all that they made huge amounts of money on, where they essentially separated the risk from the mortgage. So it used to be you would go into a bank and you would get your mortgage from the bank and then you would pay the bank for 30 years. So the bank wanted to make sure you were a good credit risk because they were on the hook for the mortgage. But now, with the securitization of mortgages, they would take anybody who walked in the door. I mean, there was all this predatory lending going on, which is a good defense to these mortgages. If you were a victim of predatory lending, you could technically get out of your mortgage. But the thing is, when they sold it off to investors, so they sold off the risk, and then MERS took over the mortgage. So when MERS goes to foreclose, they would say, well, we don't know anything about any predatory lending. You know, we're an innocent holder in due course. Well, they weren't an innocent holder in due course because they know that they're taking all these dodgy loans. Anyway,
in your first paragraph, which I thought this was key, and I only had a chance to glance at this very quickly, and you mentioned Kansas is only one of 50 states, but other courts take note of what happens in the other states. And as you say, that the Kansas Supreme Court decision is sound, so it's very possible that people could bring suits in other states and avoid being foreclosed on.
Yeah, so that's the thing. I mean, and that 60 minutes, what I'm thinking is this would give, if we got organized, this would give us some clout. You know, the bankers obviously have Congress in their, the bankers rule here. And it's because they've got all the money. But if we had an organized group of 60 million, you know, homeowners that walked into Congress as a lobby or a political action committee or something and walked up to these Congress people and said, don't listen, you know, we can bring down those banks if we all get together and walk or, and refuse to leave our homes, you know, contest our mortgages. Those banks are all bankrupt. They've got nothing. So listen to us.
I think that's a lovely idea. Another idea would be everybody take your money out of a big money center bank. Take your money out of Chase, out of Bank of America, out of Goldman Sachs is a bank too. Take all your money out. Well, I make them hurt. I mean, if everybody did it, they'd be in big trouble. Oh, we are coming to the end of the hour, Ellen. I do hear that music playing. Oh, and we didn't get the Mercury amalgam.
Oh, there's so much going on. I seem to have spearheaded this whole Mercury amalgam thing because I wrote an article that got into the, you know, progressive, democratic, well, Huffington Post.
We got to go. I'm going to send you an email as soon as we get out, but we're out of time.
Great hour,
Ellen. So much good stuff. To be continued, right?
Yeah, for sure.
To be continued. Friday, today is Friday. Join us again on Monday. Another full week of live programming.